Blog Talk Radio.
I don't know what. Hey, hold on. All right.
Nice.
We got music coming from every direction. I don't know what other. I'm doing a mix here on my laptop, I guess. So, new mix to open the show.
That is definitely a new mix. Well done.
No doubt. Yeah. So anyway, it's the Blog Talk Radio theme of the moment. So it's Michael on Drive Through HR After Dark with William and Crystal. First time we've been together for a couple of months, I think. So everybody, welcome to the show. How's it going?
It's good. Glad to be here.
Same.
And Crystal, you getting coffee? No? Okay.
I am, man. I mean, you guys want to do After Dark. I need some caffeine to keep myself up. I'm old.
Old and feeble. So anyway, we're going to do some rounds of topics here, but I did a few shows while we were on hiatus from this experiment that we keep playing with every couple of months. I did a couple shows at Sherm Talent, and I did a preview show for Sherm National coming up. So that was a little different, going to Sherm Talent and doing a four-person panel plus me all in one room. I hadn't done the podcast that way before, so it was interesting to say the least, especially since I had no equipment, so I just kept moving my laptop closer to the person who was talking. It was awesome.
Ad event logistics is if anybody could ever master that. It's really hard because you never know what they have. Are you going to be on the Wi-Fi? Are you going to have a cable? Like, there's just so many random things that come up. But first of all, I'm glad you did it. What did you learn? Like, what did you, with both Sherm Talent and with Sherm National, what did you get out of the experience?
Well, the first thing that was most noticeable is, as we were doing the show, not during the show, but all around the show, everybody kept saying, "Well, where's William?" And it was like William Tin Cup was like the guy from we were talking about hobbits before the show. It's like the guy from Mordor, man. He was like, "Where's William? He's off there somewhere." Mysterious, elusive figure that nobody now. We actually got another caller from 508. You said it was Jeremy?
Yeah, I think it's Jeremy.
Hey, Jeremy?
Hi.
Uh-oh. Hi. Hello. It's Michael and William and Crystal. We were forewarned you might be coming on, so you feel like joining into this mess?
And you're live. And you're live. It is a live audience, just FYI.
All right, yes,
and
I'm
that
here.
Means cool. That means that we're probably talking to ourselves, and some people will listen later, but you never know. But so anyway, William,
hey,
go back to your question.
What I learned
was that Sherm was interesting because Andrew Morton was there at Sherm Talent, and Sherm actually invested a whole bunch of time and energy this year into really getting into the really moving the organization towards really investing in talent across all their platforms, I guess. And I hadn't been to Talent that conference in a while, and it was a nice show. They seem to have some good plans with Kat Cole and Jim Knight, who are summer camp and TDN2K alumni and good friends and all that, spoke. So it was a very familiar show, but it was a lot different than the Sherm National, and that was fun. And I think doing podcasting with them, they really went out of their way, Sherm did this time around, to really try to bring people in to be interviewed, and it was nice to kind of have the facilitated event. So that I don't know if I learned anything, but that was kind of a cool part instead of scrambling for guests every day and all that sort of thing.
Did you find that they focused more on technology or implementations or process or things like that at Sherm Talent than Sherm? Sherm Annual is a lot of diversity, it's a lot of compliance, it's this whole tapestry of HR, but not as much about tech. Go ahead.
Well, you know, they had the Peter Weddle saying it wasn't. I guess they partner, so they had the TA Tech thing, which I didn't go to. So there was a whole slew of tech people there on Saturday and Sunday, and some of them hung over till Monday, and marketing people. And then you had the more traditional, I think, SHRM talent acquisition people coming into play. I didn't go to a lot of sessions. I was doing some other stuff, and the sessions I did go to were the kind of around the ones that I podcast. So they had a panel with somebody from Amazon and Weddle and Tony Lee, who's the new editorial or the new content guy at SHRM, and a pretty good discussion about talent acquisition. I didn't really delve into it like you and Crystal would have probably as with the content, because I was, like I said, I was doing some other stuff around the podcast. So
big question there. No, go ahead, Crystal.
Oh, sorry, I was going to say, shamefully, I admit, like, your thing prompted me, the podcasting of SHRM Talent prompted me to go check and realize that my SHRM membership was out. So, like, I just renewed my SHRM membership. I have no idea how long it's been expired. But man, I got inundated with emails, like, immediately and wondered, you know, I wonder if all of this communication changes their conference attendance at all. Like, do you think that helps? Were there a lot of people there? Or not?
It was about 1,400, I think, probably a little less than that, but they said around 1,400 people, which is, you know, 10% of the big, their national show. That's huge, right?
Yeah.
A pretty good exhibit hall. I mean, there, you know, Indeed and some other folks were there. Like I said, we kept looking for William, and everybody kept trying to find the Smashfly booth, and it wasn't there, so... They missed that one, but no, it was interesting. Sackett wrote a blog post about it, and he actually called it, you know, because he goes to a lot more of that stuff than I do, and he actually said he thought it brought a lot of cred to the organization, that he didn't know that SHRM could do it that way. So I thought that was an interesting viewpoint from somebody who's a little more inside baseball than I am on the talent side.
Yeah, so I'll give you the scoop was, I flew in Monday and had a dinner. You and I stayed at the same hotel.
Right.
And I had a dinner for Smashfly, and then I flew out the very next morning at like 6 in the morning. So I was technically in Orlando, kind of ish, for the bit. But I only saw people... related to the dinner at Smashfly. So I didn't see anybody else, even though I probably should have or could have in some ways. But
yeah.
Would you recommend, and here's the trick on the William Tin Cup thing. So if anyone ever does this to you again, just say, I just saw him. I just saw him. He's right up there. And just kind of have people going around.
I felt like I was your handler. I was like, William's not quite ready yet. He's still composing stuff, but he'll be out soon.
Yeah, the job you did, the job you'd never want to have, right there. let's. I do have one question. One last question about SHRM Talent. Would you recommend it to folks? And if so, what level are we? Advanced, intermediate, beginner, like? If you would recommend, I think
I'd recommend it. I still think it's probably a mid level generalist. I mean, they had some strategic stuff, you know, and it's like SHRM National on a mini scale, right? So they had more senior level tracks, but I think if somebody's trying to go and learn about talent or hone their contacts, it was a really good place to do that this year. It seemed like. I don't think it's for really senior people, at this point, unless you're there to present or do something in a, you know, from a booth point of view. The TA tech thing was probably a little bit more of that. So that again, yeah. So that's it on SHRM. So, Crystal, did you get coffee yet, or you got a take on something?
I'm paying for it now.
All right, well, then we'll go to William and see if maybe we can bring Jeremy in somehow.
All right, so I, coming back from New Zealand, so I've created a LinkedIn post today about software vendors, and the shtick in the LinkedIn note is actually exactly what played out. So I'm doing this bit in New Zealand about time management, And after the bit, a bunch of people were asking me from the stage that we went through Q&A, and a lot of people were asking me, how do you hack? How do you get your time back? How do you hack, and how do you get smarter about what you're doing? And so conversation pivoted over to software purchases, as it usually does with me. And, I'm sitting there just standing in front of 300 people saying, listen, you're not good at it. You don't do it that often, turns out. You're never going to be really great at it because you don't have any muscle memory. But, you know, one thing I'd suggest is that you do 3 or 4 or 5 demos a week of software, even if you don't have the intent to buy. Just familiarize with what's going on in the technology landscape, because hell, the four of us, you know, there's just the four brains that are, you know, on the phone lines right now, we might know 5% of the market.
Oh, just totally.
The five of us. All right, I mean, the four of us, right? So first of all, and then I posted it, and so tweeting and all the other bullshit that comes with it. But what do y'all think about that? First of all, is that good advice? Now that I'm
no, I think
it,
that's great advice.
And
yeah, I mean, it is. Yeah. So it is. I'm so focused on a narrow thing now that I've been doing demos just to kind of see what's going on, because I really feel like I'm a bit out of touch. And it's been really interesting to have that contact and to kind of see where technology's, you know, headed in ways that I hadn't really paid much attention to over the last year or so.
So upside and downside to this is I tell people, hey, if you have trouble getting started, send me an email. And then over the 48 hours of travel and, you know, whatever else, I got a lot of emails of people saying, hey, what take you up on your offer? Where do I start? And so I was going to go and build a list for each person and send them a list. I'm like, yeah, I can't do that. That'll kill me. So I created a list. Now, the upside of creating a list is I've been tracking these firms already, so it wasn't a lot of work that way. The downside to a list is you leave people off. And so, you know, I'm sure there's a bunch of fucking people cursing my name because they weren't on some goddamn arbitrary list about technology plays, and I couldn't list all 21,000. Hey, no one would read that. And so I got it down to like 133 or something. I mean, it was a random number, and I just said enough with this madness. And I just stopped. I just randomly stopped. I put it in alphabetical order. I'm like, yeah, done. I'm enough with this madness. But, you know, what do y'all think? I mean, so first of all, about the bit about practitioners doing demos, but also, you know, does it help with a list? Do you think it's helpful to have a list? Should I have made the list shorter? Should I have given a more narrative about the plays? Like, what could I do to make that better?
There's no end to a going about this. Like, if you left that thing open for weeks and got more feedback and thought of more companies, there's so many companies in our space right now. Your list would have been 1,000 in no time, and so the value of that is, you know, there has to be quality software amongst all those products that you're mentioning, and it's, you know, you look at the list that you put together. There's some crazy names in there. Some vendors I never even heard of before. But I
wondered about that. How much when you popped through the list, how many of them had you either heard of or done the demo? Because you do vendor selection, you do implementation, so you see technology in a much different way than I do. How many of them were at least familiar in words?
I would say a quarter of them, honestly. I mean, there's the bigger name, like Core HR type products in there. It's just such a mishmash of different products.
Right.
You know, and some of them, there's so many point solution these days that, you know, you got people solving for one tiny element of the entire HR space. So, you know, it's like, and you've got some like learning products or platforms like AppLearn. It's just it's a cool list. You got CloudMills that does integration work, which, you know, technically product wise, that's not their focus. So it's a really interesting list, but it's not, there's a bunch that I've never heard of.
Yeah, I struggled to put them in a category. Like, when I was looking at my little categories, I'm like, they don't fit. But I'm like, you know what? At the end of the day, they're getting these technologies to work together. Let's just see if it fits there. And I've only had one vendor today ask me to recategorize them. One.
That's kind of a
only
win,
one.
Man.
And it's from a firm that I advise. they're like, oh, yeah, if you could just kind of put us over in this category, that'd be great. I'm like, oh, yeah, sure. Yeah. Like, I could say no to that. But, okay, so it's going to be arbitrary. The cutoff's going to be arbitrary no matter what. And I'm just going to have to deal with the heat. Go ahead.
It has to, right? There's too much there. But I think you hit on the key phrase in the beginning, which was, this is a place to start. So, I mean, if you give people too many options, they don't start because they don't know where to start there. So I think giving them 6 to 12 options in different categories is probably appropriate and let them go from there. And if those 6 to 12 don't do anything for them, you'll hear back from them because people are always okay with saying, I'm still lost.
The reason I find this so interesting is that you said, you know, should the HR practitioners be doing demos of these things? Should they be checking them out? Like, to me, there's so many wacky solutions out there that do such specific things. I'm curious to see what the practitioners actually think of them, if they think that they're actually products that they'll get use out of, you know, and they're valuable to them. Because if they go through the list and they do the demos and they don't find things that are valuable, then you begin to wonder why they were created in the first place. So that's, to me, the value of stuff like this.
There's so many products, though, that were created, as a – it's almost like a solution-seeking a problem as opposed to a solution-solving a problem, right? They're nice to have. They don't really – they're not really, like, game-changing for your organization. And there are a ton of those products out there. It's surprising to me.
Yeah, I had some VCs actually ask me to go back through the list and tell them stories about acquisitions and revenue amounts. I'm like, that's I'm a consultant. That kind of sounds like work. So I pushed that off to, I'd love to do it. You're going to have to write a check, though. But I also had some people ask for more narrative, more, if you could give, it's like, give me some pointers, like, what should I be looking for? And the struggle that I have with that is I'm one of these hardcore, I've been painting since I was 9. I'm one of these artists that I don't even like title cards next to artwork because I don't want to give the user, I don't want to give the person in front of the art any clue as to what it's about. Like, you're supposed to experience it, in my opinion, humble opinion. You're just supposed to experience the art. You get out of it when you get out of it. So I hate those things where they take you on a fucking tour and tell you, oh, the artist was thinking this, and he was doing this, and he was doing this other thing, and you should think this. Like, yeah, I've got my own brain. Go fuck yourself. I'm going to think whatever I'm going to. So when people ask me to give them more, like, what are the pointers and what to look like, I had this vomit-like reaction, like, no, I'm not going to do your fucking homework for you. I'm trying to point you in a direction to go look at some really cool software. And that, for me, that's enough. That's the job. Like, that's the bit. But so the good news, if there is any good news, I've already got 42 plays from today that asked to be on the next list. So 46 different companies sent me a fucking email or tweeted or whatever.
It's a great lead builder. It's part of it, but the other part, is the psychology of lists. I think, the psychology of lists, right? That, you left somebody off or you didn't put somebody on. I thought what you did, and I didn't look at the whole list. I actually threw it in my organization's newsletter as a resource because I could see that it had use, but I didn't read every vendor on the list. But I thought what you did is just share a resource as opposed to, cast out, something that's these are the top 25, whatever the hell they might be, things that William loves. That's where people get crazy, I think,
Agreed. Had I put numbers next to that rather than bullets, holy shit. Like, today would have been a murderous type of day.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, it's just dumb. People need different things or at different places. And like, I think the world of hiring solved right now because I think it's actually a company that's going to displace LinkedIn. But if I put them number one, that would make them somehow more important than Clinch or, Smashfly or somebody else that I feel just as passionate about, but just differently. It's in a different part of the tech stack. So anyhow, thanks for the feedback. And if you'll think of anything, I'm going to do one. I'll probably have it ready in June, but I'll publish in July. And I'll do the same thing. I'll try to make it better and get people's feedback. So thank
you. If you guys want a little psychedelic experience too, go to Kaleo's website. It's KaleoSoftware.com. I just took that off of your list, and it's like all these fish swimming around. It's actually pretty cool. I'm like mesmerized by this thing.
Jeremy, we just kind of threw you in the mix here. Why don't you tell people who the voice is, the mystery man voice?
Oh yeah, yeah. So I'm not on William's list. I keep going up and down the list here, and he didn't include me, so I'm a little pissed off right now. But my name's Jeremy Ames. I'm president and founder of Hive Tech HR. We do HR technology consulting, so we do selection work, implementation work for a bunch of different vendors. Some of those vendors were on his list, which is cool. And that's it. William and I have been hanging out at conferences now for a while, so some of the conferences you were mentioning, I go to. I'll be presenting at SHRM National next month. Pretty cool presentation with Jamie Nodder, and that's it. I like the concept of After Dark, so that's why I'm here.
Jamie working with Charlie Judy now, I think?
Probably. We're doing a cool thing. It's called Computers Plus Culture Equals Cash, so trying to capitalize on your technology and your culture to translate into the bottom line, so that's what we're talking about.
That's cool.
So before we move on to a different topic, I actually had a point that I'd like to make. Is that cool?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah. So the one thing that I see with this, like, William, the thing that I would recommend when you do the next bit is, like, there's inside of the HR tech bubble and outside of the HR tech bubble, and some of the different categories, I think some of the options outside of the HR tech bubble that's being used by either mainstream marketing or in other areas of the business are players that need to be looked at, and people don't even know they exist.
Totally agree.
I only had, if I were
honest with myself, I had 4 to 6 of those. Like, Hey Taco is it's a rewards and recognition play for Slack. So basically, inside Slack, you can do what Achievers and Global Force and all these other kind of recognition players do, but inside Slack. So I totally get what you're saying. It's they don't perceive themselves as an HR tech, and so some of it is hard to find them because they don't perceive them in our category, albeit we perceive them in our category.
Right.
Well, at least a part of our category, right? So,
right.
Yeah, I love great sound advice, Crystal. I mean, if you find something along your travels, as you see shit, just text it to me or email it to me because it'll be helpful.
What's
can't keep an eye on
right
all of
now
it.
Is the virtual platforms, right? Like, so when you look at, so I'm working with a company right now that one of the things that we're looking at is college recruitment. And if you can't go to all of the different companies, it's not, universities and stuff, it's not possible. But even within I'm going to go to 50 different universities within the course of a year. And I've got maybe 24 that have really high levels of contribution in terms of yield hires and their performance over the subsequent, 18 months post-hire. So those colleges, those 24, I'm probably going to go to them first, right? Because historically they've proven to perform. But I need to have a showing at these other places, so how do I do it? And one of the things that's really interesting to me right now is virtual, like a virtual career fair that you can utilize through both the faculty and college recruitment. I talked to probably 20 or 30 different enterprise-level professionals that HR professionals that they had no clue that existed.
Yeah.
Like, wow, because I would think with your hiring volume, that might be really good for you. So that was a new one, and almost all of the solutions are outside of HR tech. There was like one that would be considered in HR tech, and then everything else has been outside of it and used more towards like B2B type trade shows.
Oh, that's cool. The more we make people aware, the more people can start to consider it, whether or not they do it or not, or whether or not it becomes the future or not. Like, let the practitioners suss through that, in my opinion. Let them suss through that. Our jobs as kind of these people that, that work around the edges in some regards, is to make sure they're aware. Like a part of what we should be doing is make sure they're aware. So I love it. I mean, first of all, it's mind-blowing because we're just trying to get our hands around, like, all the payroll plays, like global payroll plays. If anyone on this call can list the global payroll plays, I'll give you $1,000.
I can't.
You can't. There's no one. Even Jeremy, who's actually probably closer than anybody else, he can't list them. We can't list them.
No.
You know, the people that are doing global payroll can't list them. And then that's just within that little bitty tiny bubble of the insider, like Crystal said. Outside of that, getting them to become aware of all of those kind of hacks or new technologies is, I think it's, you know, that we've got years of work just to make people aware. Because it's not happening in academia. It's not happening at SHRM. It's not happening
right.
in certifications. Like, where are they learning technology?
It used to be IRA, and it still is.
You know, that's the other real question, though, William. Do they see that as their job? And it's fascinating to me, and particularly at the director level and above, how many of them do not see that as part of their role. And it's like, dude, I don't mean to be rude, but you're missing the mark. You know, because you're going to make tech buys for your organization. So how do you know that you're making the right one? Are you just, like, answering the one who emailed you the most or irritated you the least? I agree. So how do you not have demos as a weekly or monthly part of your life to make sure that when you need to buy that technology, you understand it?
Yeah, but, you know, from the practitioner side, though, I mean, like working at Publix, if we needed something, I know that they didn't do weekly demos. What they would do is they would do an RFP and say, we want this type of play. I was on a cross functional team looking for a suggestion box solution to replace pencil and paper, and they looked at tools like Jive, Yammer, and a few other things. And it was not just HR people. I mean, it was your purchasing people. It was training people that, you know, kind of fell into other areas of the company. This is a big, massive corporation, but even with hundreds of HR people, they didn't have anybody who was looking at HR tech in that way. I mean, the
IT really
department
begs,
was.
Michael, it really begs the question, and this is right in Jeremy's wheelhouse, actually. It begs the question, you know, should they be the one, should they hire a consultant? At the end of the day, there's just too much. It's all the world's oceans. How the hell can I, you know, like the guy that lives down by our, at our lake cabin, the guy that lives next to us, is an expert fisherman. And he's fished on every lake in Texas. And so he takes people out professionally. And whatever fish they want to find, he takes them to the appropriate lake, knows exactly where to go, right? Well, that's kind of like what some consultants do in some regards. Should HR and recruiting not follow the tech? And should they just hire people? Like, is RFP the best way to buy software?
No.
Yeah, I don't know if it is. I don't think it is, but I also know that in the real world of day-to-day HR, you don't have time to just sit around and watch demos all day, you know? I mean, because you're watching all kinds of other stuff as well.
There's a difference between all day and I'm going to set an amount of time, right? Like, we had this conversation in one of the groups on Facebook, and it was like, if you take an hour out of your week and talk with 2 to 3 different technology providers. And depending on what part of HR you're in, this may be more of a big deal, but like if you're in the recruitment marketing and the employer branding area, which, you know, is my role, so I don't mind being a little critical of this, like I don't understand you if you don't pay attention to technology. Like I just don't get you because you've got to pay for advertising, you've got to use tech, it's involved in almost everything you do, so how do you not pay attention to the technology? Right. Now, if you're an HR generalist, I don't know how much, you know, that may not be as big of a deal. So some of it might be role specific. Jeremy, what's your thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, I'm a little biased on this one. And I try to tout myself for not being biased in the selection process because we don't try to steer people towards particular vendors. But I would obviously steer HR towards using a consultant. You know, the real value, though, it's putting the bias aside. The real value is not necessarily, you know, it's getting that list shortlisted by just talking to the HR people without, you know, you try to keep them out of the vendor demo room, right? You do that by listening to their requirements and getting them to, you know, 5 vendors instead of the 50 that they would have started with. So that's what we try to do, is to try to make it a shorter process just by, you know, the starting point being further along and then automating the whole selection process instead of the old school RFP process.
Yeah, I'm all for not following the old school RFP process. I mean, some of that, and sometimes it works well, right? But it almost feels like it's just kind of a crapshoot based off a lowest bid, which isn't necessarily the way you want to select software.
Yeah, I white label the product that does selection. It, like, you can send out the RFP, it does the scoring, it does the vendors can actually go in and submit their responses through it, so it just makes it a lot faster. So that's, you know, one way or I used to drive me crazy when I'd have to work on the old process.
What's lost in the RFP?
Any sort of personality, like the stuff that we're trying to bring to this phone call. Life sucks the life out of you.
Yeah.
No, but it's too long. It's, you know, you have a starting point of a requirements document that you've used from every single, you know, selection process from the beginning of time. So it's just everything gets added onto each other instead of really looking at what's important to a company when they're looking for software, you know, to them specifically. So that's
right.
That's why RFPs and then the vendors all just get cookie cutter, you know, as far as how they respond to things and their proposals. And it just sucks the life out of the selection process when you're really trying to make it an energized thing.
Well, you've worked behind the scenes on this, so I'm really curious. Is it like resumes in that you're really looking to ding people? You're looking for the, oh, yeah, didn't go to Ivy League, ding. You know, you're standing over a trash can, you're letting the resumes go. I mean, I should start with my bias. That's how I typically look at resumes. I mean, what do they don't have? I don't give a shit what they've accomplished. What do they not do? Like, where's that? I'm looking for holes. I'm looking for weak spots. I'm looking for all that stuff. And it seems to me that RFPs might have a similar characteristic. Oh, it's not multilingual. Ding them. Oh, they don't have offices in 3 countries. Ding them. And it seems like there's that line of thinking and just pure, Crystal said it, cost. How much is this per employee per head? Per month. Like, what's the bit? And those people win. And you're the only one that's really been on the back end of this stuff with a lot of clients. What do you see?
There are knockout questions. You know, there are questions that if you don't answer it right, you're gone. Like, I had a client recently where if you didn't know how to handle a cafeteria 125 plan, they didn't want to talk to you. And then a lot of times it has to do with, you know, high-level functionality. If you don't do global payroll, or in some cases, if payroll is too much of your product suite and they're just looking for core HR, then you're also gone. So there's a lot of reasons you can disqualify yourself and fewer that you can stand out, really.
Wow. How much does price pay the ultimate decider?
It's client by client, you know. We've some that just say they're not going to pay above a per employee per month cost, and others that are just like they'd rather end up with the right software. So it's all variable.
So
go ahead, Crystal.
Yeah, I'll shut up.
Some of the things that I see that are missing on the RFP list, or when you go the RFP route, is some of the conversations that you have with the implementation team. You know, the references seem to go a little bit differently, but the implementation team is a big deal of it, right? I mean, once you buy this software or you buy this technology, it's got to get implemented into your company, and there's a whole process around that. And it seems like, at least in the projects I've been involved with where it was very heavily a purchasing department-driven RFP, they didn't do the homework around that. And so when the implementation team came in, there was a lot of, oh, the salesperson said that the product is this. And, no, well, it doesn't really do that. You know, so there's like a whole new layer of discovery post-contract. And it seems to cause some problems. But that's just been the experiences I've seen. And then I'm engaged to somebody who's in implementation. So they have a wonderful sales team, and that's not a problem they have often. But still, they've heard stories, right? So it's interesting to me. I think there's a better way.
Part of what I ran into was, like, you know, we'd look at, I was on a couple of those teams, and one of the other teams was not as massive of a project, but we were looking at innovative, you know, kind of new emerging companies as a potential solution versus somebody who is more established, had better financial standing. And from the corporate mentality, especially from the purchasing point of view, they were really looking at, like, if we invest X amount of money in this company and go through all the hassle to put it into an organization that approaches 200,000 people in size, are they going to be here next year? Are they going to be here in 5 years, right? And so a lot of times the companies that were cooler and faster and more agile got cut out of the process, the RFP process, because they didn't really have the legs to stand on for those big companies. So I think there's a perspective, you know, depending on which side of the organization you're on and the size, too.
All right, I got an ethics question. Are we ready for some ethics? Anybody? Anybody? No one? So I overhear this conversation at a conference, and the conversation goes like this. It's a consulting group that stands in between the client and the technology vendor. And they're negotiating a 7-year deal, and they negotiate with the vendor that there'll be no rate changes, zero rate changes. Like, what is in the contract, it stays the same. No matter whatever happens, who gives, it stays the same, no matter what. But they've negotiated with their client that there's a flexible, there is a rate change to be noted. You know, every year there's a maintenance, there's a change, if you will. So I got me thinking about, well, so first of all, that's just profit. Hey, on one hand, that's actually kind of cool. You're just making money for doing nothing but just great negotiating. And then the sadder part kind of came in that, you know, the practitioner might not know that that's happening. They might not know. And if they did know, they'd probably want that value extended to them as well. So I don't want to make a mountain out of a molehill here, but do y'all see any type of ethical dilemma in that? And if so, how do you solve that?
We're all stunned.
Well, there you go. Done.
I'm trying to grasp the scenario a little bit better here. So this was a consultant who was talking with the end client and
the implementation shop.
Okay.
The vendor selector implementation shop. And they're negotiating both sides of the contract. And the contract is with the technology vendor, they're giving them a fixed rate.
Right.
And with the client, the practitioner, they're giving them a variable rate. So it's fixed, but there's a variable on top of it that is an unknown. And each year it could be cost of living increase, et cetera. And so, you know, first of all, that might just be common practice and just that's normal and that's what we do. And that's where we get some of our profit. But it just seemed odd. Like when I totally overheard this conversation. So, I mean, this is, you know, a little bit inappropriate on the, I mean, this guy sat down next to me. It's not my fault. So, He was doing a call, and I just overheard it. And then I asked him when he got off the phone. I'm like, couldn't help but hear, you know, your deal. He goes, oh, yeah, we do that with every contract. We negotiate a rate. We negotiate them down, and we get them fixed. And then the spread in between that and what the practitioner pays, profit.
Well, so what you're talking about isn't really new to the agency side. So agencies do the same thing. Like your TMPs,
right.
And,
right.
You know, similar agencies. They do the same thing all the time with technology purchases. And, I mean, the standard is 15%. Sometimes it's more and sometimes it's less, but that's kind of the industry standard. I do see an ethical problem with that. I can't, like, in my little firm, we don't do that. It doesn't make me better or worse. I have a hard time saying this is the tech you need to buy if I'm getting a kickback off of it.
Right.
Which is me. But, I mean, I'm in the minority. Most agencies do it.
Yeah, and in my case, we do selection work, but we also do some servicing of implementation partners, and we don't do referral fees, so we're not incented for people to go a particular direction, you know, in the end, you're gonna make your money from doing work. So why do you have to make anything extra? You know, that's just kind of a general rule, but you know, there are those who try to take advantage of those situations.
Yeah, it seems dirty. You know,
yeah.
It kind of seems dirty. If you're making a kickback, unless you tell the person, you know, it's like, hey, these are the firms I represent. Like I've seen guys, gals that are HR consultants, and they go in and say, I represent these 10 technologies.
Right.
And they do the bit. They show demos. They talk about the pay. You know, who's paying me is very clear. You know, the vendor, if you end up buying them, the vendor will pay me. But more often than not, it's not clear like that. Go ahead.
And you said that's what the buyer should be asking. They should be asking the selection people, how do you make your money? If they're working with an implementation team and it's not clear how they're making their money, they should be asking that as well. So, you know, people are afraid of asking those questions. And if you don't ask, there's a decent chance you might be taken advantage of.
Yeah.
Well, so what gets me is when it's done sneakily, right? Like, so I won't name the agency, but I was a secondary agency with one project, and they were trying to renegotiate a contract with Glassdoor. And it was really, I think it can put the technology providers in a very sticky position, right? Or you know, whatever software their company they're working with. But in this particular case, it was like, hey, you're going to need to fix the pricing to X when the pricing was really Y. And they did not want the end client to know that their kickback was in there. Like, they were just like, we don't really care how you get that 15% in there, but the price that the client needs to see needs to include our 15%.
Mm.
So the client's the one, and that's, that was an eye-opener for me. So then I started paying more attention. The client's almost always the one paying that 15% override, right? And
right. That's
not disclosed anywhere. So it's for a lot of times, I don't want to say unilaterally because I don't see everybody's deal, and that's when somebody's going to be like, well, I always say this is what it is, right? But for the most part, you know, the companies that I've talked to and the things that I've seen, it doesn't get disclosed, and that seems super sneaky to me. Like,
do you think like a master person, a consultant or an agency that negotiates all the vendor contracts for someone, do you think that's a good model? Like, and I'm thinking of TMP as I'm thinking about it, is because TMP for years has had that model where all vendors go through TMP. If you're there, the agency of record, then everybody has to, if you're whatever, employee advocacy software, screening software, whatever the bit is, you've got to go through them, and then they negotiate the contract. And I'm not picking on TMP. They're a good company. It's not the bit. That model of centralized, you know, ownership that's not procurement, that's outside of the company, and they negotiate these types of deals a lot, is that a good model, or have you seen where that's good or bad?
So I don't think it's bad. I just think it needs to be disclosed, right? So, like, I don't actually have a problem. Not that anyone cares if I did, but I don't have a problem with the fact that TMP wants an override on it, right? Like, I mean, that's fine. If they're doing that work, they should make some money off that. But and I know some of their, I don't know all of their deals, but I know some of their deals, they're not working on, like, a set project price. They're working on a retainer against services billed. So how do they bill for that? Maybe it's by the hour or whatever. But the solution that they've come up with is this override. So, okay, well, that's cool as long as the client knows that it's happening, right? If the 15% is your service charge for running through all of these vendors, you know, actually assessing them, figuring out which is the best one, and then selecting it, that's fine. But
shouldn't you know that? I mean,
yes.
The assessing thing. So am I paying you to learn, or am I paying for your knowledge? And if I'm paying for your knowledge, then shouldn't that process be shorter?
I mean, one would think, but you have to look at sort of, right? I mean, like, there's a lot of different technologies that things have to integrate into and processes that are specific to each company. I'm not an implementation specialist, so I'm going to hit the edge of my knowledge, and Jeremy will probably pick up and run with it much better. But I know that there's a lot of company-specific things that you have to think about, and how that might work within one particular company may not work the same way with another. And that's a lot of different scenarios to cover.
No, she's right. Yeah, I mean, it's definitely that's the key, is that vendor selection isn't just evaluation of software. It's evaluation of the company. It's evaluation of how it's going to fit, how you're going to coordinate with that new company that you're now dealing with. You know, whether or not they outsource their implementations, and if they do, if it's successful, there's a lot that goes into it. So there is definitely value that needs to be paid for. It's just, you know, how it gets paid for, whether it's upfront or if it's on the back end, that I agree that it needs to be disclosed somehow.
How much does vendor selection cost?
Wow. Now we're cutting to the chase. It's after dark. We can ask anything.
This is what we do. This is what we do. During lunch, we had to, like, oh, man, anybody could be listening now. We're like, hell, shit. We're going to get right at it. How much does it cost?
How big is your company?
I'm a 5,000-person firm in Tampa, Florida, in the healthcare industry.
Wow, that was very specific. And are you looking for HR, payroll as well? Is it all full suite?
I'm brand new VP, just took over. I'm unhappy with everything we have, from core all the way up.
Even the people? Do you want to get rid of people too? Because we can outsource to people.
Yep. I'm not attached to people either. I am not attached to anyone at this point or anything. All I see is numbers and money flowing away from me and no value coming to me.
Mm-hmm. I would say for anywhere, I'm going to give a range because this is not my company quoting you. This is like what I know of me and my competitors. So between anywhere between probably $25,000 and $70,000, more than likely somewhere in the middle of that is probably what that type of a company would pay for that selection work, and it would hopefully last somewhere between, depending on how intense they are, between 3 and 5 months. And if you're really fast, slightly less than that, but usually 3 and 5 months.
And everybody wants to work faster, and you get a lot of pressure there. But what's your first 10 things that you do? So you got the deal; it's $60,000. Okay, checks in the mail. What's the first bit? Like, what do you do?
Cash the check.
Yeah, no shit.
No, sign the contract, then cash the check.
No, I don't care if the contract's signed. Check's coming. Check's there. Move that money into another account. Yep. Totally tracking.
Fly to Florida. That's what you do, because you gotta be in person, you know, shaking the people's hands, really getting down to brass tacks, find out what they've already done, you know, all the work they put into it. They probably already have some lousy requirements that they put together initially that you need to use as a starting point. So that's step one.
Do you deal with process at all at that point? Like, say, take recruiting. So we hate our ATS. We have a brass ring. But hate it. It has to be gone. You know that, and it's part of the bid, and so you're going to help them. Do you get into the recruiting process at all?
At all during the process, during the overall thing, yeah, but not right then. At that point, no.
Why is that?
Because you need. And I'm just giving you away all the secret sauce. So this is just.
We're recording this, by the way.
Great.
It's actually live, and then it'll be available forever on archive. Yeah.
Nice. So anyhow, you were saying.
You need to build your high-level categories first. You need to find out which of the 8 to 10 areas of HR and HR technology they're looking for, you know, because then that's going to determine what path you take. So I think I should probably stop this now.
No, you should. You should. I'll send you an NDA in just a couple minutes. You know, I've been saying lately, and no one's really slammed me for it, so I'm expecting it any day now. But I've said from the bloody pulpit, process eats software for breakfast, in that you can put inferior technology on a superior process and it'll still work, whereas you can't do the opposite. If your process is shit, I don't give a shit what you put on it. I don't care. Pick your favorite darling software. It won't fix the underpinnings. If your process is rotted, you're fucked. So the reason, now, first of all, I say it just like that. So I get a lot of, you know, I get a lot of people looking up in the sky. But the thing is, it's really in my heart that that process has got to be right. It's got to be right. And you put technology on top of a process. But when you start, in theory, you don't start with process. So I'm worried.
You get to it. You definitely get to it before you make the selection, but you don't start. Just, you're not going to sit down immediately, you know, a week into it, and get all the heads of recruiting and talent acquisition together and talk about their recruiting process and how an applicant moves through the process. That's too early to do that. Before you end up selecting, before you end up implementing, you definitely have to go through that, but just not out of the gate.
Is it too? Are they too vulnerable at that point?
Too vulnerable.
The question is like, is the reason that we're not doing it is we haven't built enough trust yet, and it would be really hard and it's painful and we're going to be telling somebody their baby's ugly and halfway retarded and all that other shit. And so, like is that why we don't do it? Is it ego?
I think there was another point there that I overheard.
We're 30. I don't know. We had 90 minutes, which I didn't realize, but yep. So we got like 8 minutes left for an hour. And somebody in the 352 code. Well, hold on. We got a random integer here. Somebody from the 352 area code is either listening in or calling in, and I don't know who it is. But I turned them on.
Oh, don't put
so
somebody
you're there,
on the spot, man.
Hey, they called me.
Put them on the spot.
At night. So just trying to see if anybody had anything they wanted to add to this conversation.
No? My goodness,
cool.
I'll tell you, what is the conversation about tonight?
Uh-oh.
A lot of high intelligent talking going on, and I'm trying to figure it out with a can of Bud Light. So what are they talking about tonight?
William, is that you?
No, not me.
Okay, back on hold on that one with the Bud Light. It might have been Nicolaisen, I'm not sure. We actually got some live real-time great. We got some real-time feedback on Facebook as well on it. And
great.
A guy named Noah, which says, grateful for your work and all the experience you and your guests are bringing to light. I'm a newbie in the field, but not to management, and appreciate and value your viewpoints. However, pretty please work on the audio quality. So I guess we got to stop doing this from our basements and stuff. So.
You know what?
That's
I've got a microphone just for this. I should probably start bringing it out and just doing it through there.
Dude, that seems reasonable. That seems reasonable. That is
it
a
does.
Reasonable request
it does.
Right there. Well played.
So we'll have to work on that. So we probably should wrap up pretty quick here. Anybody got one more take they want to go through? Or
Jeremy's got one. Come on, Jeremy, take us out. What do you got?
I mean, I really just want to know about the guy with the Bud Light. Is he gone?
He's gone. Yeah.
He's been muted.
He's been muted. With that.
Yeah, because that could have gotten wheels off real quick. So we just that got you.
So I have one to get out before we close. So after Jeremy, can I do one too, or can I do one before Jeremy?
Yeah,
you go first, Crystal. It's all you.
Okay, sorry. We had three things that we were talking about. I didn't talk about any of them, but the only one I need to talk about is the employer brand conference that's coming up on Wednesday.
Yay!
So GSMI is doing an employer brand conference. Many of the people that we know and love will be speaking there. Craig will be talking about some of the things that they're doing in the state of employer branding at CA, which is cool. And I think Susan Sestrella Lamont's there, Jason Seiden's there, Brian Chaney's there, you know, Belinda Appleby's there. So there's a lot of different people there. I'm left out like a ton of people, so that's great. But what was interesting to me and what I'd like to get your take on is you know, are these kinds of breakoffs into specialty-type conferences, is it needed or is it noise? Now, I like GSMI, so I'm excited about this conference. I'll say that up front. But like, at what point do we need a separate conference for the specialty areas in talent acquisition and HR? Or is it better served to get large organizations like SHRM to just have more tracks at their conference and send them where they're probably sending it other people anyway? What are your thoughts?
I'll go first. So since Henry Ford, you've moved away from mass production to specialization. When I got my first car, it was a 79 Cutlass Supreme, sky blue, tinted windows, big wheels. It was an amazing car to have in high school. But I could work on the car. I could open up the hood, and there wasn't a thing in the engine that I didn't know and that was intimidating that I couldn't understand or figure out. So changing out a fuel pump, you know, that was actually relatively easy. With my Mini, I opened the hood once, one time. I opened it up, and I looked at it, and I said, okey-doke, we're good here, and closed it. And so the era of specialization actually came from Henry Ford and afterwards. You can see it everywhere. You can see it in sports, baseball. You used to have pitchers that would go the entire game, a complete game, and it wasn't that really that abnormal. They'd pitch every other day, every day. You know, now you have people that are just fifth-inning pitchers, sixth-inning pitchers. Eighth-inning pitchers, closers, ninth-inning pitchers for left-handers. You know, so the specialization, I think it's just our life. I think you can't put that air back in the bottle and make people generalist again. If one tracks towards generalism, great. But most people, I think, early in their career come through generalists, then they become specialists. And then as they get promoted, they come back to being a generalist. But I think that specialization, we've seen it for years in diversity and inclusion, in compliance and the law, legislative agenda, et cetera. So it's just kind of hitting, for us, it's hitting some of the things that we've cared more about for years. But I just don't think you put, for me, I don't think you put the air back in the bottle.
And I was going to say, I mean, that's exactly what I do, is the conferences I run are very narrow, very narrow niche, but a very wide discussion about that niche. And we've been doing that for like 40 years, so it's not even new. It just depends on if there's a market. You know, we talk labor relations, we bring in lawyers, we bring in practitioners, we bring in consultants, and we chop up five topics for 3 days, you know, because they're all nerds about that stuff. And they've been doing that literally for 40 years. So, yeah, I think it's probably a good thing as long as there's a market for it.
I personally don't like monopolies, so just giving it all to somebody, whether it's, I won't list the names, but if you give it to one of the big names, that's not really my style. But then again, I'm also a bit busy and maybe call it lazy, whatever. I don't want to have to hunt for something, and so I'd rather have it be somewhere in the middle ground where it's a conference that I'm familiar with, but that is covering content that I might not always, you know, be exposed to. So I'd like to see somewhere in between.
Right on. Fair enough. Well, that was the one that I really wanted to make sure that I covered with you guys. I like the specialty conferences. I think it's interesting. You get a different level of conversation, right? Because everybody there, to some extent, either is doing what you're doing, wants to do what you're doing, or has already done it for long enough that you can learn from them. So that to me is cool.
One of the downsides you run there is that everyone, it's the end club. So then it becomes a bit where only these 50 people really kind of quote unquote get it. And you start to believe that. And you start to believe that you're the only ones that kind of quote unquote get it. And you forget that, you know, there's, a ton of people out there in the world also innovating. So we've seen that too. We've seen that where people kind of get into a cluster and it's like, okay, everybody here, we all get it. And everyone that's not here, they don't obviously get it because they're not here. And that's one of the things that you run a risk of at a specialty conference. But that's, I mean, if you know it, you avoid it.
I'm doing a cool one just the next couple of days. It's talentsummit.io. It's a digital event sponsored by HireVue and Glassdoor, but it's like got a premise of the whole election to it, and I think I may have taken the election part of it a little too far in my presentation. So if you see it,
did you talk about Germany? Yeah. Germany, 1938, Hitler's opponent. If you did talk about that, you should. I mean, because I told my wife earlier, I'm like, you realize there was an election in Germany, and Hitler, the Nazi Party, actually won that election. The people of Germany voted Hitler. People forget this. They voted Hitler into power. But back then, if you listen to the rhetoric, it wasn't about we're going to annihilate the Jews and we're going to go through all that. It was all economics. Germany was in a bad way post-World War I, and all the rhetoric was, let's just say, very Don Trumpish. It was very much, let's close our border, let's focus on economics, let's get our deals, let's get people employed. That's how Hitler ran, and he had opponents in that race. People tend to forget that. Anyhow, no, I don't think you can take it too far. I think you can go much further. As you go. Oh, and I would be very supportive of that.
Orton, never talk religion and politics. But
oh, no, try to cross them all off the list.
Yeah, just
say, listen, we got to talk about sex, politics, and religion, and drugs. We're going to go through the vice wheel. Let's spin the vice wheel really quick. Okay, gambling. Who the fuck doesn't gamble? So, yeah. See, the only problem I have with virtual events like that is the economic model. So companies get together, vendors, three or four or five vendors get together, they co-promote, they get a bunch of people to put free content together, and the free content is some exposure, there's no list sharing, so it's not like you get the copy of the list of the people, even that attended your event. Maybe you get that, but you don't get the list of everyone that attended, and they don't pay you to do it. So essentially it's just a different way to con people into doing content. But that's a little... Again, I'm a little cynical.
Yeah, thanks.
But,
I'm so excited now about this event.
No, yes, that's what I'm here for. I just don't like the economic model. Like if they said all the same things and said, listen, we're going to give you, $5,000 for your time, then I'd love it. Because it's recognizing, hey, you're going to have to put some shit together. You're going to spend time, money, and energy on this. And that exposure shit. Listen, if there's a single vendor in this fucking, in our market, that can give me more exposure than just the three of y'all, I want to know who that vendor is. They don't exist. So exposure doesn't, it never meant anything. And it damn sure doesn't mean anything to the likes of the four of us. But I mean... If they change the economic model, I'd be down. Sorry, Jeremy.
No worries.
I just completely shit all over that. My bad. Sorry.
It's
getting late and I'm hungry. Yeah. My bad. Sorry about that.
I'm sure your presentation's going to be massively successful now, Jeremy. Kill it. Break a leg and all that kind of stuff. All right. It's past my bedtime, so I'm going to call this show done. It was a blast. But So anybody got any last things, or can we get out of here?
No, we need to all attend Jeremy's.
No.
Right?
All I do is talk about process for you, William. That's it.
Good. Somebody's got to. Good God.
After he gave away all of his trade secrets. All right.
Yeah,
this is Michael. And I got the board, and actually, I do. You got one more thing, Crystal?
I think that Jeremy should get the opportunity to give shit right back to William, because I think William's got a webinar coming up too, and that is kind of like a virtual event.
I do have a webinar. Now, they did pay me, to their credit. Lever did pay me. A small fortune, actually. Anyhow, so yes, I'm completely whoring myself out. If we need to lay those cards on the table, I'm completely happy with that, because I like the CMO. When she was at LinkedIn, I really, really just had a great relationship with her there. And now that she's a CMO there, I like the play. I've actually demoed the software, and they're paying me a small ransom to do a webinar. So yeah, the economics work for me.
And you're going to talk candidate experience, which works for me, so yay.
You see that? I just changed my tune, right? Like one, it's just like right on a dime. What was the deciding? Oh, yeah, it was a check. That's the difference.
Boy.
Now, I used to say that, you know, as consultants, we're all prostitutes. It's just a question of zip code.
Wait, is this the after dark show? Did I?
No,
we're still on. I'm trying to hang up on you people, but you won't shut up. You won't let me.
People that live in northern Georgia
don't start, you people.
Ever.
The three of you, including the one who cashes the check. All right,
yeah.
So it's Michael, right, who just committed a horrible social faux pas. I'm going to say goodnight. Thanks for doing the show, you guys. Jeremy, thanks for being a guest. We'd love to have you back. I'm going to play a little music and get us out of here.
Night, guys.
Good night.
I do got some later. The ubiquitous tribute.
Just makes me sad.
Don't be sad.